Today marks a major deadline for state lawmakers. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Monday, March 8th, and this is In the Moment. This is the final day for bills to move out of the state House or Senate. SDPB reporters Lee Strubinger and Seth Tupper join us to talk bills they're watching, including the controversial bill blocking transgender high school athletes from competing on the team that corresponds with their identity. Later this hour, we continue our In Their Own Words series with debates on changes to the absentee ballot application process. And University of Sioux Falls Associate Professor of Criminal Justice Mike Thompson updates us on the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Jackie Hendry, filling in today for Lori Walsh, and you're In the Moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. A company with direct ties to Governor Kristi Noem's cabinet received nearly $600,000 in pandemic relief money from the state. Companies registered to a cabinet member's business associates received millions more. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
Hague Companies received a small business grant from a state coronavirus relief fund. The company's most recent annual report for 2020 says Steve Westra is the company's vice president and secretary. In January of 2019, Westra became commissioner of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. He filed a financial interest statement showing income from Hague Companies at that time. Cabinet members are not required to update those forms each year. Other corporations are registered to Hague Companies leaders Paul and Peter Hague. Their holdings include real estate, hotels, construction, an assisted living center, and a property management firm. SDPB identified grants to at least seven Hague-affiliated companies, totaling $3.6 million. The money came from the state's share of federal coronavirus relief funds. Westra did not return messages. Governor Noem's spokesman, Ian Fury, emailed a statement. It says, quote, "Commissioner Westra has taken a leave of absence from his private sector companies and is working for the state of South Dakota. Decisions about grant program acceptances were made by an independent third party," end quote. Conflict of interest laws forbid state officials from overseeing contracts that benefit them. In this case, it was the State Bureau of Finance and Management, not Westra's agency, that worked with a private contractor to distribute the grants. But Westra's office was involved. One of his state employees conducted a webinar explaining the grant program to applicants. The state's Government Accountability Board has authority to receive and investigate conflict of interest complaints. The board consists of four judges. Democratic State Senator Reynold Nessaba of Sioux Falls says he doesn't know if Westra did anything wrong.
But everyone in public service should be very careful to keep themselves above even the appearance of impropriety. And so this sounds problematic, although I haven't looked at it closely.
The revelations about Westra come after media outlets reported that Governor Noem's relatives received about $600,000 in state coronavirus relief grants. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper.
Like many other cities across the U.S., Sioux Falls saw a spike in crime last year, specifically in homicide cases. According to police, there was an increase in violent crimes and a slight increase in property crimes in Sioux Falls. Despite the increase, crimes in the city were solved at a rate that beats the national average. Authorities say record or near-record amounts of methamphetamine, heroin, and fentanyl were seized last year. Sioux Falls police have solved every homicide over the last 20 years. A fungal disease that's fatal to bats is now showing up in Wind Cave National Park. White nose syndrome has killed millions of bats in North America. It's not known to be a health risk to humans, domesticated animals, or other wildlife. These are the first confirmed cases in Wind Cave. Park staff are asking visitors to stay out of closed caves and report any sick or dead bats. People should also avoid contact with the animals. Bats use caves for winter hibernation. Staff protect them by avoiding the cave's walk-in entrance. Wind Cave plans to resume limited tours in the spring with added precautions. Coming up next, it's In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. We get serious about comic books with two lifelong fans creating new work that brings more representation into the superhero world to reverse what writer John Jennings calls symbolic annihilation.
By not showing someone, you're decimating them. You're destroying hope. You're destroying, like, the fact that they existed.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
SDPB provides comprehensive coverage of the South Dakota State Legislature all session long. Listen on SDPB Radio and to our daily podcasts. SDPB-TV presents late-night replays of the day's general session and access to the legislature live online at SD.net and on the SDNet app. SDPB's coverage grants all citizens access to democracy in action. More at sdpb.org/statehouse.
Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. Today marks another major deadline for state lawmakers. It's the last day for a bill or joint resolution to pass out of the State House and Senate. Our SDPB news team is hard at work to bring you the latest. Today we welcome reporters Lee Strubinger and Seth Tupper for our weekly legislative roundtable, and we're going to start with SDPB's politics and public policy reporter Lee Strubinger from the Capitol building. Hi there, Lee.
Hey, Jackie, how's it going?
Not too bad. Better than you, probably. You've got a busy day ahead of you.
Oh, yeah. The calendars are long for both chambers, but that's okay.
Right. All right. So bring us up to speed. I know a major bill that you've been watching is this. Official title is an act to promote continued fairness in women's sports. Critics say it's yet another example of anti-trans legislation in the state house. Tell us, I thought we were done with House Bill 1217. Bring us up to speed.
Yeah, not quite. So lawmakers have this procedure. It's called a smoke out. And I won't dwell on it too much, but essentially, if a bill goes down in a committee, it doesn't essentially die. And people are able to revive a bill via this procedural maneuver. It requires one-third of members of either the House or the Senate to bring a bill down to the chamber and have the full Senate or the full House decide on it. So House Bill 1217, the Continued Fairness in Women's Sports Bill, it was heard in Senate State Affairs last week, which is comprised of pretty much just Senate leadership. And it was rejected 6-3, so not by a real slim margin. I do want to say in the show open, you said it would affect transgender athletes. This is really only would affect trans girls trying to participate in girls' sports.
I see.
Yes. And so State Senator Maggie Sutton, you know, when she called for the smoke out, said that the bill was rejected in committee based on opinion, and that the full Senate should have a say on the bill. You know, I sat in the committee hearing, and I was hoping to find out what she meant by that. So I asked her if she would elaborate on it being rejected based on opinion.
No, at this point, I don't wish to elaborate. I do believe that it was merely on opinion. I think when the Senate hears the testimony on Monday, it'll be loud and clear what the bill really means.
I think a lot of people are concerned, and they would kind of just like wonder why. I suppose, you know, I guess what is the testimony then that would be compelling to for senators to calendar this and then to ultimately pass it?
This is a very simple bill. It's a bill to protect women's sports. It's not complicated. It's just a simple bill. It's not against transgenders. It's just to protect women's sports. That's all it is. It's very simple.
I've tried to read the bill and understand like what it does, especially when it comes to like cause of action. Does it allow for a transgender athlete to bring a lawsuit? Does it allow for an athlete who might perform against a transgender athlete to bring a cause of action? I don't understand.
What the bill says is that you will have to be a female by biological. So it's really simple. If you're a biological female, you play on female sports.
Talk a little bit more there, Lee, about this idea of cause of action and at what point any action needs to be taken if this bill goes through.
Yeah, so the cause of action, essentially every student athlete in South Dakota, which there are about 40,000 of them, would have to fill out a waiver verifying their age. And this is not just high school sports, by the way. This includes collegiate athletes in South Dakota as well. Mm. So they would have to fill out a waiver verifying their age, their reproductive biology, and whether they've taken any performance-enhancing drugs in the last year. And critics of the bill have called that portion of it kind of like a child genital registration act. Yeah. And so schools or the athletic association will collect those waivers. And supporters of this measure say that if at some point there's a question about a female athlete, the school or association will reference those waivers and determine what to do about that athlete.
That brings to mind a whole lot of questions, which I'm sure are not new to you, that you've been looking into with some of this. Like, you know, what's to keep, especially with like the performance enhancing drug question, what's to keep anyone from putting down the obvious correct answer? What's to keep schools or anyone else from unfairly targeting an athlete? What does that look like?
Those questions haven't really been answered. You know, obviously the school or the athletics association would have to look at that. And, you know, if they happen to be wrong, per se, they would have to go to the courts. And that's something that I followed up with Sutton a little bit more about the cause of action again. Let's have a listen.
Going back to the cause of action here, I guess what recourse do people have?
I'm not going to go into details on this.
It's your bill.
It is my bill. Let's hear it on Monday. Let the Senate decide. It's a simple bill. It's not against transgenders. It's just to protect women's sports. And I know that others want to make more out of it than what it really is. And let's not go there. It's a simple bill.
But it would really only target like one specific group of people, which would be trans girls. Would it target anybody else?
That's not the goal. The goal is to protect women's sports. It's the target is biological women to play on female sports. Period.
So, procedurally speaking, the bill was brought to the Senate floor today without recommendation. They have to calendar the bill before actually voting on whether to approve it. And proponents of the measure have pointed to the fact that over a dozen other state legislatures are considering similar proposals. Mississippi, their legislature there is sending a nearly identical version of the same bill that South Dakota is considering. They're sending theirs to the governor, which the governor in Mississippi says he intends to sign.
Lee, before we move on to other topics, I just want to remind audiences, is there a number of athletes that this bill we know for a fact would apply to? Is this a solution that we even need right now that we know of?
Sure. The South Dakota High School Athletics Association has had their policy in place for a decade, and during that time, they've had one trans girl athlete perform within the last 10 years or so. And in the Senate State Affairs Committee last week, it came out that there was an application by a trans girl athlete to play in girls' sports, and that was even rejected. And they have a procedure put in place that the Athletics Association and they say the schools are very comfortable with. So if that gives you an idea of the scope we're talking about here.
We'll have to wait and see what comes up on the Senate on the floor today. Moving on to the state Senate side, that was a House bill. Now we'll move to the state senators taking up a bill that delays implementation of the medical marijuana program. What kind of update can you give us on that, Billy?
Yeah, sure. Real quick, you know, recall Governor Kristi Noem and legislative leaders asked for about a year and a half delay on implementing a medical marijuana program. Voters had approved, initiated Measure 26 overwhelmingly in November, which was expected to go into effect on July 1st of this year. The state wanted some time to comb things out and have a program in place by July 1st of next year. The governor's office has since met with cabinet officials and says that a January 1st implementation date, January 1st of 2022, would work just fine rather than July 1st of 2022.
Interesting.
It also establishes a summer study group to look at any kind of conflicts between IM-26 and state law. I think supporters of IM-26 are kind of worried that something similar with what happened to initiated Measure 22 is going to happen. But anyways, the Senate's going to be voting on that today. I think everyone expects it to pass, and this conversation will continue into the summer.
Interesting conversation. Lee, I know you've got a lot to listen to. Chamber is already in session in some respects, so thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time, Lee. Good work.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
We're going to welcome on now SDPB's business and economics reporter, Seth Tupper, for an update on what he is following today. Seth, welcome back to In the Moment from Rapid City. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, so you have been following a whole lot of conversations this session dealing with the initiated measure and referendum processes. Tell us a little bit about what you've been covering.
Yeah, so as Lee mentioned, you know, the medical marijuana and recreational marijuana measures were on our ballot, you know, the last general election. And as anybody who's a voter in South Dakota knows, we have a lot of those on our general election ballots, typically initiated measures and referendums and things. So several bills have passed through the legislature already or nearly passed that would make it tougher to get initiatives and referendums on the ballot. Supporters say is just improving the process. And one of those that received a lot of passionate debate was House Joint Resolution 5003, which has passed both chambers. And because it's a joint resolution, that's a type of bill that does not go to the governor for approval. It goes to the voters. So legislators have decided to put that on the 2022 primary ballot instead of the 2022 general election ballot. And the question submitted to voters is whether to require a 60% threshold for some ballot measures to pass. And the affected measures would be any that impose or increase taxes and anything that would require the state to spend more than $10 million. And Republican Senator Lee Schoenbeck of Watertown supports that bill and wants voters to approve it. He says it's a protection against out-of-state groups using South Dakota as a laboratory to get their ideas into law.
This comes to us so that we can have one more protection built into our election process. If groups come, seems like these days they're mostly not from here, and if they want to put a tax increase on our ballot or they want to spend over $10 million, they have to get a 60% vote.
It speaks to an issue that I think a lot of people have been concerned about, that South Dakota is being used as kind of a lab for some of those ideas, as you said. But what do critics have to say about this move?
Well, you know, critics have a different view of it. And of course, on the Democratic side, Democrats have had a lot of success in recent years getting measures on the ballot and getting them passed that maybe they wouldn't be able to get passed through the legislature. And so they view this measure as simply stifling the democratic process. One of those people who oppose the bill is Democratic Senator Reynold Nesiba of Sioux Falls.
If there's any protections that need to be done today, it's about protecting the rights of our citizens, of your constituents, to go out with an idea, to gather signatures, and to put it on the ballot.
What else are we hearing about this 60% threshold?
Well, I mentioned that Republicans who got the bill through the legislature decided to put this issue on the 2022 primary ballot instead of the 2022 general election ballot. And there was a lot of debate about that. And some Democrats allege that the reason that was done is because petitions are already circulating to submit an initiative to voters to ask them to expand Medicaid eligibility, which many Republican legislators oppose. And if that measure goes on the ballot, it'll be on the ballot in the 2022 general election. It would cost more than $10 million to implement it. So if you follow this through, if voters approve that 60% threshold in the primary, that'll take effect, and it'll take 60% support to expand Medicaid eligibility in the state.
Trying to get ahead of that one. Another issue that you're following related to public review and comment for initiated measures. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, Senate Bill 123 has passed both chambers. It still needs consideration from the governor. Basically, it would add a public review and comment period after the attorney general releases an explanation of an initiated measure. So the way the process works now is the attorney general has to write a concise summary of each ballot question. And that summary is what actually appears on the ballot, not the entire text of the ballot question itself, which could be very long. So right now, the attorney general has to file that summary within 60 days after somebody informs the Secretary of State that they want to circulate petitions. This bill would add a 10-day comment period after the release of that attorney general summary. And then it would add another 10 days after that for the attorney general to review any public comments made and make changes. So, you know, supporters say it's going to produce a better and more accurate summary of measures on the ballot. Critics say it just makes petition circulators wait another 20 days before they can start gathering petition signatures. And they say this is another way that Republicans are kind of chipping away at the ease with which you can put something on the ballot and get something passed.
Interesting. Do we know if any other states have like a similar process with that kind of comment for those attorney general opinions?
I do not. That is a good question, and something perhaps I'm working on a story on these bills now. It's something I'll look into. So.
And speaking of petitions, this one gave me a little bit of a giggle as I was reading some of your notes. Something to do with font sizes. Is that correct?
Yeah. And so this one, you know, I saw this early in the session, and we talked about it on one of the roundtables. And you know, I guess what I would say about it again, it's a seemingly innocuous bill. It's passed both houses, but it's in a conference committee right now to iron out both the differences. But the Republican Senator Al Novstrup of Aberdeen introduced it, and he has mentioned that some past petitions, like last year's petition to legalize medical marijuana, which voters ultimately passed, it had a font size so small that it was hard to read for some people. And so if you're at a public place and somebody wants you to sign a petition, they show you the petition, that's what he's talking about, that he says, you know, some of these were as small as 6-point type. Oof. And so it seemed like, okay, well, let's just increase the font size so people can read it. But again, two sides to every issue. Democrats say this is just making it more difficult for petition circulators, because there's another South Dakota law that says you have to have your petition and any signatures you gather on one single sheet of paper.
Oh.
And so essentially what this creates is a situation where if you have a long proposed law, like the proposed medicinal marijuana law, you have to get a banner-sized sheet of paper, and it's printed all out on that, and you fold it up like an accordion, and that's what you carry around with you when you get signatures. They say it looks like a beach towel. And so their argument on this was, this is, they believe, another effort to chip away at the ease with which you can put things on the ballot, because if your font size last time around was 7 points, this time it'll be 14, and that'll double the size of the, you know, beach towel like piece of paper that you've got to carry around with you.
Huh. Well, we just have a few seconds left, Seth. I just want to touch on the Ag Natural Resources merger. This was a move from Governor Kristi Noem. It sounds like an oppositional issue is being raised today. Do we have an expectation of when we can know if that passes through?
Yeah, well, there's a resolution of opposition to the merger. It's passed through a Senate committee, 4-3. It is on the calendar in the Senate today, so we may know today. And obviously, you know, some people oppose this merger, but, you know, a lot easier to get 4 votes to oppose it in a committee than a majority of the 35-member Senate. So we'll see if that has any luck.
Interesting. SDPB's business and economics reporter, Seth Tupper, joining us. Thank you so much, Seth. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
You can find his stories and the rest of our Statehouse coverage at sdpb.org/statehouse. Coming up, listen as lawmakers debate possible changes to the absentee ballot application process. And today's In Their Own Words. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
As the pandemic set in, many of us hunkered down at home, but traveling nurses had to hit the road, jumping from city to city treating coronavirus patients.
It's like playing Russian roulette. You risking your life to go in a patient's room.
I'm Ari Shapiro, traversing the country to treat COVID this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. Even the wireless revolution needs a lifeline, and SDN is happy to provide 50,000 miles of broadband fiber support. More at SDNCommunications.com.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. Throughout the legislative session, we've brought you inside the chambers of the State Capitol Building and Pier for our series called In Their Own Words. In today's installment, lawmakers debate possible changes to the absentee ballot application process on the House floor. House Bill 1126 would change the options available to the Secretary of State for sending ballot requests.
House Bill 1126, having had its second reading, is now up for consideration and final passage. Are there any remarks? Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and members of the body. This legislation would prohibit the Secretary of State from sending out an absentee ballot application without a request from the individual voter. This simple change would help provide a layer of security for absentee voting, ensuring more confidence in the process and add another level of transparency. Absentee voting is an important part of our process that allows members of the military, the elderly, infirmed, and all others to participate in our elections when they cannot vote in person. Historically, our absentee system has been a secure way to vote. However, many citizens will agree the most secure form is in person, either on voting the day of or absentee in person. I believe we should encourage our citizens to show up to vote in person, whether that be on the election day or absentee in person. This bill does not add any requirements for eligibility for absentee voting. It simply requires the voter to ask for an absentee application or to have one printed, as has been the process here in South Dakota for many elections. This bill is careful not to damage our existing absentee process. Rather, House Bill 1126 respects the citizens' right to vote while also creating additional security. This bill strengthens the absentee voting as a trusted way to cast a ballot. It protects the voters' rights and instills confidence in our elections. Thank you, and I will stand by for questions.
Thank you for the remarks regarding House Bill 1126. Further remarks. Representative Duba.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have questions for the sponsor.
State your question.
Did we have any complaints concerning fraud when the Secretary of State mailed out absentee ballots to those voters?
Representative Dinner, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Speaker, thank you. I can't answer that question. I have not asked the Secretary of State about that. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks.
Another question, please.
Go ahead.
Were we aware of any voter fraud that occurred as a result of an application being mailed out, then subsequently getting an application and mailing it back in? Was there any fraud related there that you're aware of?
Representative Dinner, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Speaker, thank you. Thank you, Representative. Again, I did not have a conversation with the Secretary of State regarding that exact question. I do know that there were these application forms mailed out to people who are deceased, but I can't answer the question as I've not had that direct question posed to the Secretary of State. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks, Representative Duba.
You don't mind if I make comments, Mr.
Go ahead.
Speaker? Thank you very much. I believe that that's the case. There could be people who were on the voter rolls who had recently passed away. So I would agree with you on that statement. I know that this was, I got a lot of positive comments from people who live in my district that they appreciated and remembered getting the application. Some of them actually threw it in the trash. But at the end of the day, it gave them an opportunity that they really didn't even know it existed. You'd be amazed at the number of people that don't realize that there's an application process to get an absentee ballot. And so actually what this did is it simplified that process. They had the application in hand. And as we all know, when you apply and you fill out an absentee ballot, you have to prove voter registration. You have to prove that you have some form of ID that's accepted. So I would encourage you to reject this bill because I truly believe that we have the security in place to offer this opportunity. Thank you.
Representative May.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question for the sponsor.
State your question.
Can you tell me what the cost was associated with sending out the absentee ballots that weren't requested?
Representative Denner, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Speaker, I can't answer that question. I don't know how many were sent out that weren't requested, so no, I can't answer that exact dollar total.
Follow up?
Granted.
Did the Secretary of State give you any dollar figure?
Representative Denner?
Well, I don't for the ballots. I do for the application, if you'll give me just a second. The dollars that were used to pay for this mailing were CRF dollars, and it was in the total of three, and this was a mailing to every registered voter, so it was just shy of 600,000 total registered voters. The total cost was $329,381.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for that answer. Well, I'm going to give you just a little bit of clarity on this ballot thing. My mother had been gone for 2.5 years, had passed away 2.5 years prior to the election. And to my surprise, she received an application in the mail for an absentee ballot. Now, I've heard this stated here that, well, you've got to prove your ID, you've got to have a signature, you've got to have all this proof. Well, I was her POA. I had everything. I could have easily filled that out and got a ballot. So the very idea that this is going on, my thing with elections is it is we ought to be honored to be doing this. There comes responsibility with that. And we as citizens need to remember that. And I don't like to see this get loosened up like it has been. We don't know how many are on our rolls that have passed away. So it is definitely something that needs to be addressed. And if my mother had been gone 2.5 years, I have to ask how many deceased people are on our rolls. And so I wholeheartedly support this bill. I want to see our voter rolls cleaned up, and I want to see this process really tight. So anyway, and just to say that I do appreciate the idea that our military are able to do this, because I think it's important that everybody has the opportunity to vote. But it's more important to be involved in the process of it and understand it. We can't just make it be like a lottery system. So anyway, I hope that you will all support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I guess I just want to draw us back to what the bill does. And first of all, I believe, as a couple of former speakers ago said, there isn't a problem here. We have one of the safest voting systems, even according to our own governor in the state, in the country. Talking to the auditors about it and then the Secretary of State, this is a tool that was used during a pandemic and it helped. Our voting numbers were incredible. And just because an application went to your house doesn't mean that that person voted. First of all, upon the death of that person, your POA fails. It's done. It's nixed. If you would have filled that out and done that, you've committed fraud or perjury, or fraud, I believe. So that doesn't work. You can't vote for somebody else, or it's on you. What I do think we're trying to do is limit voting. And that's not what we should be here doing. We should try to get as many people out to the polls as we can. Because that's what it's about, is that right to vote and people getting people excited about exercising that right, however they do it. And so, again, we shouldn't make it harder. We have a good system in place. We don't need to change it. This is a solution looking for a problem. Please defeat this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks. Representative Goodwin, would you like to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question for the prime sponsor.
State your question, please.
Yeah, my understanding of this bill is instead of having the Secretary of State sending out ballots, someplace could be blindly or to people that aren't around anymore, they have to request for a ballot, then they send them out. Isn't that the meat of what you're trying to do here?
Representative Dennard, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I would. Thank you, Representative, for that question. And yeah, it is. This would still work that way if a voter would send in a request or submit a request to the Secretary of State for this, they would still be able to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further remarks from anybody like Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just a question for the sponsor.
State your question.
Did you consult with the Secretary of State in bringing this bill? Did he have any input? Thank
you. Representative Dennard, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Speaker.
Go ahead.
I've had conversations with the Secretary of State in the last couple days, but I didn't during the interim prior to session beginning.
Representative Chafee.
Question for the sponsor.
State your question.
Can I get this application online?
Representative Dennard, would you like to answer that question?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Representative, yes, you can. That's a fairly easy process, just a few clicks on the web, and there it is.
Thank you. Further remarks? Would anybody like to speak first time before Representative Smith speaks for a second? Go ahead, Representative Smith.
Thank you. I just want to be clear that they're not mailing out ballots to everybody. They've mailed out an application for a ballot. And that's what I want to make sure we understand what we're talking about here today, because it makes it indicate that we're sending everybody ballots. That's not what we're asking to do here. This was the Secretary of State wanted to send out ballots because of a pandemic, send them out, and there was a box on that you could check that said, I want it for the primary and the general election. And some people didn't know they checked that, but they asked for that on the form that they filled out. And they did get both, all right? So that's what happened. If somebody says, I didn't try to get a ballot, that's what happened. And secondly, this just allows for the application to be sent out. Let's not stop the Secretary of State from being able to do his job. Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing no further remarks, the question for the body is final passage of House Bill 1126. All those in favor will vote yay. Those opposed, nay. Madam Clerk, please unlock the voting machine when the members proceed to vote.
Mr. Speaker, all members have voted.
Please display the vote.
Mr. Speaker, there were ayes 52, nays 16, excused 2.
House Bill 1126, having received a vote of the majority of the members elect, is hereby declared passed.
House Bill 1126 then moved on to the Senate State Affairs Committee, but there lawmakers unanimously voted to send the bill to the 41st legislative day. Because there is no 41st day of the South Dakota legislative session, that means the bill is effectively dead. You can listen back to full debates online at sd.net under the Meeting Archive tab. Coming up, USF criminal justice professor Mike Thompson talks cases making their way through the United States Supreme Court. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
While the president and his predecessor have differences on policy, trade might not be one of them.
Everyone seemed to think that a magic wand would wave and all the China tariffs would go away when the Trump administration left, but that's not the case.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, U.S. importers in a virus economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain.
Program funding is provided by Turback Law Office in Watertown. Attorneys handling insurance and personal injury claims, willing to work hard for injured people and their families. Learn more about the attorneys at turbacklaw.com.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament.
You can catch all the action Thursday, March 11th through Saturday, March 13th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament is brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corn.
SDPB radio listeners are company presidents, board members, and top executives in businesses around the state. Your company can reach these influential business leaders. Contact SDPB and ask about corporate support.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. The United States Supreme Court is considering topics ranging from former President Donald Trump's executive order to exclude those in the country illegally from the national census to federal liability when constitutional rights are violated. Mike Thompson is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He joins us periodically to walk through the cases in the nation's highest court. In the Moment producer Chris Loffrey brings us this conversation.
Mike Thompson, thank you so much for joining us once again on In the Moment. It's appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
And just when you thought we were done talking about Mr. Trump, oh no, we're going to revisit a case, Trump versus New York. Let's talk about that.
All right. This is a case we discussed before. This is the case in which Trump, President Trump, issued an executive order regulating the census, which the Constitution requires every 10 years. And the order, just to remind people, the order was designed to exclude aliens who were not in a lawful immigration status. So the president wanted to exclude them from the census count. And the census count, as we discussed then, is very central to the allocation of members of the House of Representatives among the states. So it was a significant order. A number of plaintiffs sued to stop enforcement of that order. The district court, the trial court, initially said that that these plaintiffs had shown enough harm to them for the lawsuit to continue. As a backdrop, it's Article 3 of the Constitution that says that the judicial power extends only to cases and controversy. So it's got to be a live controversy. So in Trump versus New York, the Supreme Court decided the case and said, essentially, we're not going to decide it. The case, this is not, quote, ripe, close quote, for judicial review. There aren't, there isn't a particular lower court decision for us to review. In the court's words, it's the case was riddled with contingencies and speculation. So the plaintiff's claims were dismissed in that opinion. So we'll have to see how, if at all, the executive order actually affected the census count. So there might be more to hear on this. There might be more to hear on this.
Okay. I have just a couple of thoughts. You just answered one of them. If you could, and I know what you mean, and I'm pretty sure people know what you mean, but when you use the word alien, describe what you mean by that word in its context.
Alien is someone who is in the country illegally.
Okay, because, you know, there's going to be some, and it could have been me, that are going to think just the opposite, and, well, what's he talking about aliens for? But
yeah.
that's what the definition is. So,
true. Yep.
Reiterate, if you will, the case is not technically over, right?
Well, the present lawsuit is over. Okay. There is no pending litigation involving that executive order. But once the contingencies are gone and the speculation is gone, once we have a census count, there might be another suit that says, okay, we've got this count, and these people were illegally excluded from that count. And then that case might be heard by the federal courts. We'll just have to see. So it might not be the end of the story, might be the end of the story. It's hard to say.
I was just going to ask, and this is purely and strictly opinion, in your case, have we heard the last of this or no?
I think we have.
You think so?
Yeah, I think we have.
Okay.
I think we have. I think if you get into, it could be more of a political question, which is also not justiciable. The judges won't decide if it's a question that is
directed to the other branches to resolve, the courts won't get involved. So I think with the new administration that the issue is probably done.
I feel like I should have a gavel, but I have no right to put the gavel down on the table, so I'm not going to do that. We'll just we'll move on to a case. We've talked about this case too, Mike Thompson. This is a case where a law enforcement officer followed a person whom he had probable cause. Let's just set the record there. He had probable cause to arrest for a misdemeanor into the person's garage because without a warrant. This is Lang versus California. Let's talk about this.
Yep, and this one was argued on February 24th, mm-hmm. and in Lang, the police officer was following the driver. Mm-hmm. The driver made some driving errors, so the parties conceded. They agreed that the officer had probable cause to make an arrest, to make a public arrest. The driver, though, didn't stop and kept going. And opened his garage door and drove his vehicle into the garage. The garage door is closing, and the officer puts his foot in front of the sensor that stopped the door from closing and reopened. And then he walks in. The officer goes into the garage, which is considered part of the house, mm-hmm. and conducts the arrest. So during the arguments, the question is, how serious must the offense be for an officer to be able to constitutionally enter a home without a warrant? Here it's a misdemeanor. What's interesting to me is we have a number of justices on the court who like to interpret the Constitution according to its original meaning. So in this case, one of the main impetuses for the Fourth Amendment was the activity of going into a person's house without a warrant, and the fact that the house was sacred for constitutional purposes. It just enjoyed the highest expectation of privacy. So it looks like if you can believe what you hear from the arguments and the justices' responses, that the justices are likely to say that this was an unconstitutional search and seizure because the crime wasn't serious enough to warrant the intrusion.
On the surface, one would think that's accurate because in the real world, if you want to call it that, you can't really do that without a warrant. But that's what they're arguing.
Right. The warrant, as a general rule, the Fourth Amendment, as a general rule, requires a warrant before any searches and seizures can occur, but the court has created a number of exceptions to that, one of which is called exigent circumstances or emergency circumstances. So there are circumstances where law enforcement can enter a home without a warrant. Another one is hot pursuit, mm-hmm. but usually that's been confined to pursuit of a felon, somebody you have probable cause to believe has committed a serious felony. So I think the lower courts have been more likely to expand those exceptions to allow for warrantless home arrests for misdemeanors. And I have the feeling that the court's going to tether that a little bit and say you need to slow down. That this, what the original understanding was, you needed very serious circumstances before you can enter somebody's house without a warrant.
You've referenced it a couple of times. If you could just briefly, if I could say that, talk about the Fourth Amendment. What is the Fourth Amendment?
Okay. The Fourth Amendment prevents or limits the government from conducting unreasonable searches and seizures. So, and then the Fourth says that first, and then it says what is required for a valid warrant. And it says no warrant shall issue but upon oath or affirmation, particular description, and those things. So the Supreme Court has interpreted that to mean that if you're going to conduct a search or a seizure, you need a warrant. Mm-hmm. As our society has become much faster paced, the court has created exceptions to that requirement. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of times when you can conduct either a search or a seizure without a warrant now. But the court, as a general rule, prefers a warrant.
You use the word unreasonable, Mike, and it just, man, that word, there could be bullet point after bullet point after bullet point under unreasonable.
Right, exactly.
So who defines unreasonable? The court, I would assume?
The court. The court defines unreasonable. And the use of the term reasonable or unreasonable means that in determining whether the search or the seizure is reasonable, the court takes the position of the reasonable officer on the scene, so to speak. So and the court has defined what reasonable means in the search and the seizure context. But that's an objective determination. It's not subjective. The officer can testify, of course, as to why he did or she did what he or she did, but that impression doesn't control the determination of reasonableness.
I'll ask you this question: is this case done? I don't think it is yet.
No. We'll have an opinion issued now that the arguments are done. The justices get together, and then the chief justice will assign the writing of the opinion to one of the other justices.
So my guess is we'll hear more on Lang versus California in a future segment.
Yeah, I think we will. I think we will. It'll be decided before the end of June sometime.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls, Mike Thompson, on the United States Supreme Court. And moving on, there's a phrase that you and I have talked about in the past, and you brought it up again here the other day, that was coined, if you will, by a law professor sometime in 2015 called the court's shadow docket. Can you break that down for me and tell us what that is?
Yeah, generally, when a case goes to the Supreme Court, it gets there either by appeal from a federal court of appeals or from the highest court of a state. So in the normal course of events, a party asks the court for permission to appeal. Mm. If the court grants that permission, then the court accepts the case, sets up an argument schedule where the parties submit their written briefs, and then sets an argument time. After argument, then the court makes its decision. So the merits of the case are very well set forth for the justices. This shadow docket has arisen, and we saw it in January and part of February, where the COVID regulations were being contested under the religion clauses. Mm-hmm. So they were impacting a person's free exercise of religion, and those cases come to the court on an intermediate basis, meaning that the parties are seeking an order to stop the imposition of the COVID regulation, and so the matter is not fully briefed, it's not fully presented, it's not fully argued, but yet the court makes a decision that settles the merits of it. So you get these decisions that are not fully argued, not fully briefed, not fully subject to the court's usual decision-making process. And in those cases, the justices, the court itself, are making statements that may or may not turn out to be precedential. So it's a situation where with the way the arguments are now, people can listen. People have they have access to how the court works. And in these orders on the shadow docket, there is no access to any argument or anything for the public to follow.
Are cases such like the ones you're talking about now that are examples of the shadow docket, are they common, or do you not hear about them much?
You don't hear about the shadow docket much, I guess, unless it is an issue like regarding the COVID regulations and things. I don't think they're that common, and I don't, like I said, I don't know. So if most of those cases on the COVID regulations came out of California, so it's not. We're not sure about when the court makes a statement in an order like that. We're not sure if that will be binding precedent for later cases or not. So it's just an instance where some major litigation mm-hmm. is being resolved below the or out of sight of the court's normal process.
So in the future, when we hear the term, phrase, if you will, we've learned that they're not very common. A law professor coined this in 2015, and when we hear shadow docket, we now know what it means. Mike Thompson, thank you for that clarification.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's spend the last few minutes that we have together talking about a case, Brownback versus King. This is interesting, and I do wish we had more time. Maybe we can revisit it again. We've got two or three minutes left. Let's talk about that. Go ahead.
Okay, so Brownback versus King is a case in which James King was injured by federal law enforcement officers. Mm. We've talked in the past about when a state law enforcement officer allegedly violates the Constitution, that person can be sued using what's called a 1983 action.
Mm-hmm.
So, but federal officers as individuals are not subject to 1983. But they are subject to a case that is called Bivens. It's a Bivens case. It was decided in 1971. Mm-hmm. And Bivens allows for suits against individual federal law enforcement officers for constitutional deprivations of the Fourth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And tied in with that is the Federal Tort Claims Act,
okay.
which waives the Federal Tort Claims Act is a federal statute in which the United States waived its immunity for certain law enforcement actions. So if I am injured by a federal law enforcement officer, I can sue the individual officer under a Bivens claim. And the Bivens claim just means that remedy was created by the U.S. Supreme Court. So I can sue the individual officer using a Bivens claim. I can sue the United States under the Federal Tort Claims Act. What's significant about Brownback versus King is that the U.S. Supreme Court said that if I lose my Federal Tort Claims Act case against the United States,
mm-hmm.
that judgment prevents me from suing the individual officers under Bivens.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean it sounds very dry, but it is it's significant in the field of law enforcement liability.
And my guess is here. I'll say it again. We haven't heard the last of this one yet either.
No. There are going to be additional cases in which the Federal Tort Claims Act and Bivens work together, or they don't work together. One of the two. Again, this is it's a prime time for law enforcement liability because of the Floyd trial, which starts this week.
Yeah, we can't get to that today, but we're going to in a future segment. And inside the U.S. Supreme Court has just got to be fascinating. So we really appreciate the fact that you kind of do your best to take us inside. We've been talking to Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls, Mike Thompson, on some cases that are being heard with the United States Supreme Court. Mike, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time and, of course, your knowledge.
Thank you.